I'd like to share a reading from Mahatma Gandhi. It is possible to live in peace. If someone with courage and vision can rise to lead in nonviolent action, the winter of despair can, in the twinkling of an eye, be turned into the summer of hope. It is possible to live in peace. Nonviolence is not a garment to put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our being. It is possible to live in peace. Nonviolence, which is the quality of the heart, cannot come by an appeal to the brain. It is a plant of slow growth, growing imperceptibly but surely. It is possible to live in peace. If a single person achieves the highest kind of love, it will be sufficient to neutralize the hate of millions. It is possible to live in peace. If we are to reach real peace in this world, and if we are to carry on a real war against war, we shall have to begin with the children. It is possible to live in peace. The future depends on what we do in the present. It is possible to live in peace. I welcome you on this wondrously rainy morning and the end of April. Take a moment to greet your neighbors, even if they're a bit damp and dewy. We welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. And if you have any interest in finding out more about what it means to be a member of this wonderful community, you can talk to me. I think Shirley Hobrock is hanging out in the back. We're color coordinated today. She's also in yellow. So everyone, welcome on this wonderful day. Now let us,
Good morning. In the spirit of nonviolent leadership, I'd like to share a brief thought with you. In our society, it's tempting to think of leadership as something that only a few people are able to do, that it's something for a select few. So with the lighting of the chalice, I'd like to suggest that it symbolized the light of leading in love that's within each of us, that waits for the right environment and the right reason to be beckoned forth.
Now let us stand as you are able and sing, "We Would Be One," number 318.
Be one, how we would remain. We were born, we were ourselves anew. To that high cause of greater understanding of who we are and what in us is true. We would be one in living for each other. which binds our hearts and points us on our way. As one, we pledge ourselves to greater service, with love and justice strive to make us free.
I draw your attention to the announcements and our order of service. And for those of you who are members, it's important that you stay afterwards for the annual meeting. In addition to those announcements that are in there and the ones I just shared, we need a couple things next Saturday. Saturday is a big day, which is Chuck's and mine. Let's see, did I say that right? It's the Kansas version of our wedding, so we need some flowers, and Ann Martian, would you kind of, she's going to be coordinating flowers, so if you have some flowers in your garden, we would like this to be flowers that come from the homes of our community. So Ann's in charge of that, and we also need some help with cleanup. We have everything else pretty much staffed, so after 8 o'clock on Saturday, after the party, we're going to need some people to help clean up. So if you could talk to Terry, raise your hand. She's on the social committee. She'd be glad to pass that information on to Jane Pelletier or Courtney Albin. So, ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would please, this is the time to share a brief personal joy and or sorrow. So if you have one you'd like to share, Kathleen has the microphone.
Well, while you're thinking, I did see Barbara Hacker yesterday. She has moved to Bramlage at Meadowlark, and she's doing very well. She'll probably be there for a few weeks, recovering from knee replacement surgery. She's in 108 in Bramlage House.
I want to be Superman.
Me too. Anybody else? All right, there we go.
Many of you know that our oldest daughter has moved to Washington, D.C., and we're all happy about that. But when we came home from the grocery store yesterday, she was sitting in our living room, and that was very surprising. And then at dinner, she let us know that she's getting married. So, woohoo!
Gene Severs. My oldest daughter had a birthday last week, Jessica, and Michaela will be singing at All Faith Chapel at 3 with her women's choir group today.
Bryce Hobrock. Shirley and I returned from about 2 weeks in Buffalo, New York last night, and glad to report that our grandchildren are doing well. Just an observation. It's remarkable what social services will do for disabled children. It allows progress that would not otherwise be realized. The state of New York is a mecca for providing social services to people of all types, and in the absence in a place like Kansas, possibly, the outcomes would be much worse.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts. All right, I guess it's my turn again. I need some help. If the kids would like to come up, that would be great. Yeah, hi, guys. All right. I feel like a little distant from you guys. Can you hear me? Can everyone hear? All right. So the title of my message or story or sharing this morning is The Good Fight. Does anybody know what it means to fight? Does it mean that when someone screams at each other, is that a fight? Does it mean when someone pushes you in a mean way, is that a fight? Yeah? How about when someone calls you a name that makes you feel really bad? Is that kind of a fight? Well, I remember when I was probably about 7 or 8, I had red cheeks, and everyone called me Apples. And I hated that nickname. I hated it because it meant that I was kind of plump like an apple, and I didn't want to be seen as plump like an apple, and I didn't want to be teased for my red cheeks. That just all seemed wrong to me. And there was one guy. Do you guys have someone in your class who's a bully ever? Whoever, yeah? There are still bullies, aren't there? Okay, no more bullying now. Let's just relax a little bit, all right? So anyway, there was a guy whose name was Ken Callis, and he lived a half a block from my house, and he came from a family with only a father, and he was bigger than everybody else. I mean, he was stronger. He could pick up a kid and throw him. He was that strong. And he was often jealous of people who could do better in school than he could. And he was better at baseball and football and all those things that guys tend to like a lot, but not everyone. I didn't care about football. I didn't really care about baseball. But Ken Callis was really one of those people who could play all the sports really, really well. So he was well-liked, but he would pick on me sometimes, and he would say, I want to meet you in the alley at 3. I'm going to punch your face out. Wow, that was scary because he could punch my face out. I mean, he was tough. I didn't want to be punched. I didn't want to be hurt. And so from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, when we got between that time we got out of school, I would be so start to get so nervous about walking home because Ken Callis would follow you, and sometimes he would hit you. And so one day he followed me home, and I just got so angry. I said, I have had enough. I can't take any more. That's it. So let's go at it, Ken. So we started fighting and fighting and fighting, and somehow I got Ken on the ground. And does anybody know what a cannonball is when you're diving? When you hold your knees like this? Right? So I remembered that the first time I went off the high dive with a cannonball, I said, I'm going to cannonball that Ken Callis. And I jumped up in the air and I held my knees and I went right into his gut. And I thought he was going to get up and kill me. I really did. I was that afraid. And I ran. And then I turned around and there he was, lying on the ground, crying and crying and crying. I looked at him and I thought, I've hurt somebody. I may have won this fight, but did I really win? So from that point on, I made a promise to myself that I would never try to hurt anybody again. And you know where I found out not to do that? In my heart. because when I saw him crying on the ground, I realized that he could hurt as much or worse than I could, and that I needed to find a better way of taking care of bad problems. The fist and the knee and the boot were not good ways to solve problems. So I hope that all of you, if you ever get in a place where you're threatened, that you have the courage to say, no, step away. Don't get in a fight. And if you do, stop if you can. And if someone is threatening to hurt you, tell your parents or tell your teacher or tell someone you trust, because that's not okay, because it's not good for the heart, your heart, or that person's heart. So we all need help. And the best way to... What? You're going to name yourself Superman, and are you going to do good things? All right, that's the way to go. So on that note, let's go to your classes. Us is a part of the interconnected web of existence. Let us make that web stronger by sharing our resources, actively weaving a culture of generosity, a safety net that keeps us in right relationship with all of life, lifting up with respect and dignity our bold model of love.
I can't understand why time has to feel just like sand. It keeps running through my fingers, and it wears me all to bone, all to bone. I try to hang on, but every grain's gone. As I catch it, just like that, and you really seem like you know. Can you teach me how to let go? If you hold me, then maybe I'll see what's ticking in your eyes, and I can feel so alive. If you hold me, then maybe I'll see what's ticking in your eyes.
Wow, that was so nice. Thank you. Church music has changed for the better. I like your new song for the children to leave, too. I hadn't heard that one. I love the other one, though, so I hope you don't abandon, go now in peace, that one. I say it sometimes to myself, that the other one. Well, when I got up this morning, I just thought, this isn't going to happen. So I'm glad you're here, and now I know you have two reasons. One is you've got a meeting after, so I always keep notes because my mind's just too random. Patterns are everywhere, and I find one and go for it. I got it a little soggy, but I brought my prop, my art. I like to come on the day that you're showing art. It's just one of our posters for the Nonviolent Studies program. First, I just thank you, Michael, for inviting me to talk here. It's always a pleasure to talk with Unitarians, with people who've chosen to apply UU principles. It's that kind of wholeness, kind of hope for wholeness, that's the basis for all my work, all my life. And we've seen everybody that's gotten up here already has talked about the same kinds of things I talk about. When I try to talk about nonviolence, it's just another language for trying to get to wholeness. Also, I just want to say, speaking of woo-woo, congratulations to Michael and Charles, too. And I wanted to say, I know so many of you, sort of. I don't think she'd mind to say that after 37 years together, Kay Garrett and I got married this December, too. So, so thank you. I don't know if Kay will be back from Ohio, but if I'm here, I hope to be here on the 3rd. Michael and Charles are doing really important nonviolence movement work on all our behalf, I think, and I hope to be there. I don't know if you saw the title that Michael gave to my talk today, and I can't remember it now, but I know it had to do with patterns, and it's a provocative title for me and sends me in lots of different directions, so I wasn't sure exactly what part of nonviolent studies at K-State to talk about. For one thing, there's a lot of political things happening now, and I'll get to them at the end, maybe. But I wanted to say, I actually think here's a pattern and a parallel that the reason K-State's fought our program so much, it's complicated. But I think the reason so many people don't understand, or not the reason for it, but the evidence of why people don't value the work that we try to do has something to do with the same reason there are millions of people in Baptist churches and not very many at UU fellowships. It's a unwillingness to think in the abstract a little more than people like to do. And beyond that, I'll come back to it later if you want me to. Personally, I think the seeking patterns is my anthropologist side, and the making patterns is my activist side, or maybe my educator side. I think it's artists and poets, and I'm saying I think a lot of UUs, diagnosticians, maybe integrative scientists, those people help make patterns or make the patterns in nature more visible to us. And activists assist by pointing out some of the old patterns and bad habits that need changed. When I talked to Thea about what I might say today, everybody knows Thea, right? Thea is my colleague and all our friend. She said, I think Michael will want you to tell your story. And I said, oh, boy. Well, so it actually sent me back to eighth grade. And my eighth grade teacher, Miss Hitt, made me memorize part of Lord Alfred Tennyson's The Passing of Arthur. And I'm certain that she would be floored to know that a phrase from it really influenced my life, and this is it. The old order changeth, yielding place to new, and God fulfills himself in many ways, lest one good custom should corrupt the world. I rephrase that to say creation fulfills itself in many ways, but lest even one good custom should corrupt the world. Things move and change, and I think we need to stay aware of that and work at it. But I was probably 10 when I noticed human beings were not actually trustworthy, and that because of that, maybe life wasn't either. How could you trust something so fragile and temporary? Lots of people close to me that I knew well, and even a lot of people my own age, died within a pretty short period, like 10 years. I think maybe when I was about age 10 to age 20. And it was evidently an impressionable age. And before anybody knew to pay attention to anything like that. So I kind of sat with it and lived with it on my own. And I began to ponder exactly how to trust anything. That is, if trust meant there had to be absolute answers and that things had to stay the same forever, what was secure? I'm certain all of you have had similar worries and wonders. One day, when I was a teenager, after I'd ranted something like, "If you aren't outraged, you aren't awake," to my mother, she said to me, "Well, if you don't trust people and you don't trust the Bible or the country, what do you trust?" And she was always a good devil's advocate, and she didn't demand absolute answers. But I think it surprised both of us when I immediately knew and said, "I trust patterns in nature." And then being a good daughter, I said, "I trust you too, Mom." I'd like to say in retrospect that trying to find something to make life worth more than death would make it seem, which is how I phrased it at the time, isn't a dreary motivation by any means. I think it's made me realistic and led me to focus on essentials. And I'm certainly not unique in that outlook. Einstein said, "Once you can accept the universe as matter expanding into nothing that is something, wearing stripes with plaids comes easy." I looked in a lot of places for patterns and meaning beyond the natural world, including anthropology, and like many in my generation, Eastern religions. When I came upon philosophical Taoism, it just felt true to me, like somehow those 3,000-year-old Chinese astronomers and philosophers articulated my own thinking. I know now that one reason it spoke to me was that it's based on an organic worldview. It's not an exclusive belief system and dogma set out in a motionless book. It's something living that we can go outside and rediscover every day. From my perspective, I'll just say quickly, I think of the Tao as one whole system where everything interconnects and belongs. There are zillions of smaller but equally whole systems within systems. From outer space to inner space, it's all connected, interconnected, and embedded within and filled with patterns that need to maintain organic balance to survive. Everyone and everything is as unique as a snowflake, to be sure. And for any system to survive, diversity and change are mandatory. But even snowflakes fall into drifts we can identify and learn from. Patterns are literally everywhere and include, for example, the rings in trees, the migration of ducks, the development of a baby, the seasons, the color wheel, language, culture, trends, voting, and other habits, on and on. Even bad habits form patterns. Luckily for us, because when we learn to see them, we can change them. One helpful and enlightening aspect of systems is that parallel characteristics and survival requirements apply to all living systems, including, I would argue, relationship systems, which brings me to nonviolence. The bottom line is, when we understand human interactions as relationship systems, we can also see violence in all its forms as unhealthy imbalance in the system, and nonviolence as what we can do to correct course, to adjust and readjust, to maintain the system. This is true whether we're talking about a brain, a marriage, a lake, a community, or the whole ecosystem. If we can see our interactions as an ecology of relationships, then nonviolence is what we do to keep them green. So that was sort of the philosophical piece, but I'm going to skip a whole lot of this story, but I became a student of nonviolence my second day on the job as director of the K-State Women's Center. A faculty friend, Tori Dickinson, a lot of you know Tori, stopped me on the sidewalk and said, "Every semester I have students in class who've been raped, not just one or two, but several." And then she looked at me and said, "What are you going to do about that?" Good question. What was I going to do about that? Suddenly finding ways to attend to the endemic problem of community violence was my problem. Two things helped: my own predisposition for a holistic systems perspective, and the coincidence of reading that the UN would name the first decade of the new millennium a decade for a culture of peace and nonviolence. Our nonviolent studies program began in my mind then in the late 90s, and in actuality in 2000, K-State held its first season for nonviolence, in fact, just after 9/11, 2001, when Dori Lambert, who's director of the Counseling Center, Tori, and a number of other kindred spirits helped start the campaign for nonviolence. And brief insert into politics, the campaign for nonviolence, we had to practice nonviolence strategies just to survive, just to make it happen. And one of the first, well, the first one, was to talk Dori into being the chair of it, because she wasn't in my reporting line. And so she could work without being told to stop, basically. So that was kind of how we started. When I started to imagine how I could do anything at all about violence, it hadn't been terribly long ago that, as an anthropology student myself, I learned about misuses and abuses of power on a global scale between dominant and minority cultures in colonial settings within various forms of personal and institutionalized unfairness. So it didn't take long for me to see that even in this local setting, imbalance created by misuse and abuse of power was parallel across systems. On a campus, in a country, in a bedroom, or in a boardroom, a bully is a bully. If we were to be serious about reducing violence, we needed culture change. And that had to start with making violence visible, another little point of politics. I want to show you these newspaper, maybe I just stop and do that. This newspaper heading, for example, this was maybe my first interview with the Mercury when I became director. And it almost makes me laugh to think, oh man, I know they could just barely wait until I left, until this could stop. But it starts out saying, "More sexual crimes occur on campus than students think, Women's Center director says." Well, I think it's sort of important to point out that the Women's Center is under the PR arm of the university. So another point of politics, there's a structural problem that remains today. So anyway, drawing from the holistic perspectives of anthropology and the principles of both biology and philosophical Taoism, I could see that the same way bullies share attributes, other basic principles of living systems also apply across systems, whether they're large like the world filled with people in relationship, or just two people, or within our tiny little community. In any relationship, abuse of power causes imbalance, and that characteristic is parallel, whether we're talking about a human body, a marriage, or the ecosystem. The seemingly separate parts of a whole system and the smaller systems that compose it, like the endocrine system or the lymph system, need to maintain healthy balance to survive. The collective, as well as the individuals in it, require an opportunity to thrive, or the whole organism becomes out of balance and begins to fail. Thinking about the whole and the parts at once is not something unheard of, although people don't like to do it. Every mother knows it. You think about the each individual and the family at the same time. Coaches know it. I'm told unit commanders in the military know it. Unit cohesion. Thinking about relationships as living systems and how to make them more resilient became the basis for a logical, non-moralistic way to conceptualize and respond to our inevitable conflicts that I call everyday nonviolence. It's a demystified nonviolence that everybody can practice. It's also the foundation for the way I and my friends organized the K-State Nonviolent Studies Program. Through the practical and immediate focus of the Campaign for Nonviolence, we identified problems, unfairness, discrimination, abuse, anger, stress, isolation, the need for visible, accessible ways for students and others who were troubled or in trouble to find help. We even did more abstract things like introducing social justice ideals and examples and through movies on the grass and trying to broaden perspectives of a short-sighted student body that tended only to watch Fox News. And the list went on, the list of problems and conflicts that can be addressed before a crisis are endless once you start looking for them. But then, instead of only calling the police and the therapist, or protesting, or agreeing to organize yet another cleanup, all of which kick in after the fact, we began projects to teach in a participatory way how to see these seemingly single issues within the context of a whole community system. How to know what a whole healthy system looks like and come to expect it, identify imbalances, and then imagine what we might do to correct course. When you make the intentional effort to step back for context before you begin, you see connections, patterns, precursors, warning signs, plus a lot of clues in the knotted ball of string that describes any complex issue, and get clues how to proceed. You can see analogies and parallels that can help. For example, that violence always throughout history has led to more violence. Trying to end global conflict with war is parallel to trying to stop a marital dispute with domestic violence. Some universal lessons are easier to see up close and personal, and students are excited when they begin to learn how to do that. Through this university-wide grassroots all-volunteer campaign for nonviolence, we devised positive, integrative, and usually fun projects to address the imbalances before they got worse. noontime yoga for stress. Thank you, Dan. Dan still teaches. Empty bowls for hunger. We adopted Highway 177 out by the I-70 to help, and I took my classes out, to help them just get a feel for their own relationship with the universe, with the environment. For the universe, we started meditation program and made it an educational experience so we could get away with doing it. But people learn to think of, yes, I do have a relationship with the whole universe, and just what is it? And again, that list goes on, because, and this is the good news, opportunities for positive, nonviolent action are also endless. When you know what a healthy system looks like, see the problem in context, find connections, some of them will be precursors that you can influence. And then you proceed with intent to get ahead of the crisis, the violence, and the system failure. There's really no end to the good that individuals and groups can do if we break ourselves away from the traditional problem-solving mode of wait for the blood before you do anything. In his book by the same name, Paul Hawken called this movement to get ahead of the violence the blessed unrest. I call it the global nonviolence movement. But it's really a movement of movements. And I don't think many people see it yet. But all those movements, whether you're saving whales or working against domestic violence, share the mission of moving some dysfunctional system toward better health. It's encouraging to know Gandhi was right when he said, it isn't important what you do, but it's very important that you do it. Why? Because as Mother Earth teaches, it's all connected. Whatever we do, it will add up. When we ignore and deny the imbalances that lead to violence, it adds up. When we make even small efforts to step up and insert positive energy intended to correct course, it adds up too. I like to tell my students, nonviolence is both hopeful and edgy. Hopeful, because you get to be for things instead of always against them, and edgy because successfully applied, it will change the status quo. I'm convinced that if we carry out nonviolence projects over time, in not too many years, people who compose these seemingly single groups on campus, that would mean noontime yoga, which has hundreds of people that have gone through that in the last 12 or 14 years. Safe Zone, who had thousands, literally, have been trained to be visible resources for people. Not to solve problems, but to help find the place to go. Movies on the grass, etc. These people, these groups, begin to overlap and recognize the overarching mission to build a safer, more equitable community. At K-State, after just 15 years, lots of people have a conception of what nonviolence can do. And even when we're discouraged, it's helpful to remember lifelong activist Dorothy Day's, I can't tell if it's an encouragement or lament, but she said one time, our work is to sow. S-O-W. I find myself saying that. It doesn't matter that only one person showed up. Doesn't matter. Our work is to sow. A few years ago, I read a story about the now late Nobel Prize winner in economics, Eleanor Ostrom. And I knew she just lived in Indiana, and I knew she was interested in community and in systems. So I sent her part of my book that lays out the systems-based view of nonviolence. And she wrote me back and said she saw how we at K-State were, quote, building community around nonviolence. I knew we were trying, but I hadn't really thought about it exactly like that. That's the overlapping communities. And that's exactly right and what we hope to do, still hope to do. When individuals or whole nations focus only on violence, we allow it to be the organizing principle. Not for our jobs, too, for the economy. We hire police, we'll build more jails. We try to stop it, you know, but it's the organizing principle. But if, on the other hand, human beings can change our minds, and I like to think of it as kickstart the frontal lobe or, you know, update our worldview. We can let nonviolence be the organizing principle and learn to build community around nonviolence. Again, though, in my work, I use the phrase everyday systems-based nonviolence purposefully, because nonviolence isn't a quick fix. It's an insight and a practice that every one of us can learn to use. But if we hope to get ahead of some of the violence and change conditions that lead to it, we need to practice it every day. And there's a million analogies for this. But we need to learn to pull the weeds before August, you know, is a pretty good one. In my opinion, the urgency of nonviolence is this. No matter how passionately we may long for a peaceful world, safer homes, or healthier selves, human beings will not be able to change from violent to nonviolent problem solving until we learn to recognize and utilize systems. Everyday nonviolence removes problem solving from emotion, from personal blame, from it being a personal issue of good and evil, right and wrong. It isn't even about being nice. It's about the logic of system sustainability. Martin Luther King, of course, said it all poetically. Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Everyday nonviolence says violence cannot produce sustainable relationships. Only nonviolence can do that. That's it. I have more pages that are all scribbled up because they're about the politics. Maybe you have questions. Maybe you'd like to get out a little early. But I'll just say that there's been a wrinkle in our work the last couple of weeks. And I don't know why people have resisted nonviolent change so much, but you know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. A hierarchy doesn't want to change. The status quo is working just fine for a lot of people. And in order to really change it, I think we did a pretty successful job, but we'll see now that I'm gone and now that Mary Todd is gone from the Women's Center. Dori Lambert's not running Campaign for Nonviolence anymore. LOPA D is not coordinating Safe Zone anymore, because, you know, the power structure is just strong. And that's why I was so discouraged. And when Thea and I were talking about it, we realized the work is to sow. And all those little projects that we built have the opportunity to continue, because you can't fire volunteers. It's actually pretty awesome. You don't get change from the top. Truth trickles up. And I think a lot of them will continue. Just because the institutional site of these programs for the last 15 years is basically kaput. It's now going to be back under the recruiting arm, the PR arm, the arm that worries about important things like keeping the doors of the university open. And so I get it that it's necessary not to offend extremist legislators and parents who write the checks, who really don't want change, don't see the need for change. But I'll end with the good news. Quite a few years ago, in 2003 and 4, really, thank you, Charlie Perkins. Charlie, you know Charlie? A lot of you do. Charlie is a Unitarian who was here forever. And he was also a conscientious objector in World War II, and he had just this innate feeling, like I'm sure a lot of you do, about what we were trying to do. And the good thing about Charlie is he was a professor emeritus from psychology, and he had the clout to get some things done. So he and I just started teaching nonviolent studies classes through the honors program. And because people knew him, they let us do it. So that was more than 10 years ago now. And that piece of it, the nonviolent studies program, is still alive. And although we still don't have any funding to speak of, thanks to the vision of Sue Mays, who's director of distance education, now the global campus, which is nice. She also sees the value and started letting us build our programs online. So we have a large and growing bunch of classes that are electives, from anthropology, from social work, from drama therapy, from all over the university. Again, it's really horizontal, broad-based movement to try to share these ideas through no matter what your specific discipline is. And I really am going to quit. The last good news is when we had to turn in a 3-year plan to Sue Mays, and what I realized is at least 4 and possibly 6 students who were in my first 2 or 3 classes are going to teach for us online. So, I mean, I think that's just the best possible news. One of them's an attorney in D.C. One runs the sexual assault programs in Wichita. People are out there doing good work, and they also believe in nonviolence. So they're going to tie them together and make a class. Eric, we pestered Eric. And he was in my very first nonviolent studies class and wants to do it, but I'm sure, you know, he's busy with his new job, and we'll work on him later. But anyway, it's still going sort of in spite of the odds. And as I think that we could expect, Gandhi knew all these things and said, in any nonviolence movement, first, they ignore you, which they did forever, which let us build this network. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. And then you win. The thing is, you have to hang in there long enough to do it. So. Thank you. Okay, if you have any questions, I would give it a try. And if not, we'll go have a meeting.
Okay. So my question is, you alluded to something that happened. What happened? Did they specifically disfund your program?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to be so ignorant.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think Mary Todd, who took over the Women's Center director after I retired in 2010, she quit the other day, more or less in protest because, you know, attorneys, sorry, Charles, want to check boxes and make sure they're covered, make sure the university doesn't get sued. And I know you're a good lawyer. But what happened was there's a lot of regulations that have come down from the federal government, which are important regulations. That should not mean women can't have an advocate. It should not mean that anybody who walks in the Women's Center is required to report to the police. Now, we've always provided confidentiality, and we had people come in, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. It's not like violence doesn't happen. It's that if people think they're going to get in this system that is not nice to people, they don't come. And so it's been, you know, pulling back and pulling back. And now it will once again be a reporting office, which means nobody will come. And so Mary quit. The other piece of it is, after I more or less traded my last 3 years at K-State with a promise that I'd leave after those 3 years if I could hire Mary Todd to do the advocacy, which I wasn't very good at anyway, and could have 3 years to try to develop these programs. And to their credit, they let me do it. They were very happy that it ended. And I think it was sort of, that was in 2010, and I think it was like, okay, you know, I mean, we'll just let this fade away. And I think that's more or less what's happened to the rest of it. But I come back again. We were all volunteers. So it's possible, and I think probable, that a lot of it will continue. Do you think noontime yoga will continue?
Yes.
I do too. You know, people just step up. It feels good to do, to make people so calm in the middle of their day. It gives you back. And so I actually think a lot of the programs are like that. Empty Bowls just happened the other night. That's such a fun project that brings the business community and artists and volunteers who sell the bowls and take the money raised. And Hibachi Hut gives soup. And every dime of that money goes to groups that cook hot meals for people here in town. A lot of these things will keep going.
Hi, Tom Phillips.
Hi.
Yes. I wish I had something about the solution, but I'm afraid. Mainly, you know, I moved here for a job, and I knew it was Kansas. I used to live in Oklahoma, so it's not, you know, and I knew that my vote in national elections was symbolic, not going to help the Electoral College. But that's fine. I didn't really worry about it until the pictures of guns on every public door with a line through it and a date, which is now long past.
Yeah.
But then I hear what's going on in Topeka. So now I am afraid after July 2015, I guess. I don't know.
Is it when people can carry guns?
Yeah,
if I were still there, and I would invite you to organize.
Oh, yeah.
I just cannot imagine the faculty not getting the gumption up to stand up and walk out.
But also, it's the reality.
Yeah, I know.
The reason they got the sign there are people walking around with concealed weapons, and it's legal.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah.
And now the state wants to make it so that any local ordinance doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Anywhere in the state, you can... Oh.
They did.
Yeah.
Oh, they did do that. Okay. So, I mean, there may be even 1% of us sitting here today that have a weapon. I trust the folks here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't trust them. Mm-hmm. So please calm my fear,
yeah.
And you have
well,
really what you...
It takes actually just one person to start that conversation and organize. And so many people are afraid, faculty even, don't want to lose their job. I mean, and who would? But I still think there's power in numbers. There's power in truth, first of all. You got to be on the right side of the argument, which you are. But then you are. People cannot carry guns to class. I mean, it's just crazy. But then numbers, just numbers. It only takes... and students. Students have more power at K-State than any faculty person. If they get onto this, and so many students are wonderful, way ahead in their thinking... Get the, like, Students for Environmental Action and say, this is not a healthy environment. You know, something like that, I would definitely organize. And also vote. Vote, vote, vote. I tell students, not only vote, run for something. Yeah, yeah. I'm tempted, but you know what? You can't even go to a federal park anymore. There's concealed weapons on parks.
Thanks, Susan. I appreciate your work at K-State and always have been a fan from a distance.
Thank you.
I want to ask you a question. You talked about change trickling up.
Yeah.
And one thing that's been really encouraging to me lately in the news are all these groups of young women and others on campuses who've been filing cases under Title IX. I think the most recent one was Columbia.
Yeah.
A group of women who said, we're not going to take the fact that sexual assault and other violence is covered up.
Yeah.
On this campus. What do you see that doing? Is that changing the scenario?
Well, you see how, I mean, you know, we've been trying to do it. Make Violence Visible was a project that Mary Todd started, and she's even made a little booklet where actual K-State women have told their story. You know, we're trying to do that in a way where people don't necessarily have to go to the police if they don't want to. I think it was a real good day when people could start to file civil suits rather than just criminal suits. I mean, I suppose you could do a class action suit. There's tons of things you could do in a particular location, I think. And you know what I would just ask you to... Mary Todd is such a wonderful teacher and speaker. And if she can calm herself down and make notes so she doesn't just go off, she would be a wonderful person to have come talk about that very subject. And tell her I already spilled the beans. She knows what happened. I mean, she'll know you know what happened.
Charles here.
Hi, Charles.
You know, huge populations in this country, and probably in other countries, get passionately involved in athletic contests.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice when I watch these that sometimes I'll go, oh, man, you know, we should do something to them just like they did to us, you know.
Yeah.
I wonder, have you thought about that?
Yeah.
Paradigm and... Well, I guess I won't load the question up anymore, but just how does that relate?
Yeah, say a little teeny bit more about the question.
I'm sorry?
What do you mean exactly by the question?
How does it,
because people get so all
because large,
patriotic about a team? Or?
I think large groups of people get emotionally involved in sometimes violent contests.
Oh, okay.
Car crashes in NASCAR. Brutal fouls in basketball. Concussion injuries. All kinds of different things. Baseball players hit in the face with a pitch. I mean, it's endemic to sports at the higher levels, for sure. And it just seems to me that maybe that desensitizes people to violence.
I think I actually talk a lot about that in my little book called The Tao of Nonviolence because I want people to get it, that we're never going to stop conflict. Conflict is natural. We're never going to stop all sports just because people get hurt, or probably even international fighting because we don't like it. But we can learn to manage it better. I think the thing that systems teaches is that there's 358 degrees worth of possibilities beyond the 2 degrees of either black or white, of either my way or the highway. There's, you know, there's lots of things you could do that are more a middle ground. I don't know what they are right off, but I enjoy football too, you know, and yet I don't want people to get their heads crushed. I think there's a lot of room between either or, either stopping it or not, and systems teaches that, and I think people can learn it. I think we need to update our worldview from dualistic, which is either or and can lead only to extremes, to holistic, that lets you see more possibilities.
Gene Seavers, over the years, I work in Willard Hall. I run the wood shop for the art department. And Nicole Copel is a good friend, and I've made many bowls. I'm a potter and donated to the Empty Bowls. And anytime I find somebody that's taking a class in your department, I usually ensues a pretty good conversation. And but personally, this year the poster that I see in above the water fountain and on the bulletin board, it's attention grabbing. Aspect is bare skin. At least 2 years before that, it was in bold type, war, women against rape. And so every time I went to get a drink of water and walk right by the poster by my door, I had to kind of flinch and wrench into my gut. I admit I did not take the action that I wish I would have, because I saw that as why would anybody with a main concern for violence, not only men against women, but vice versa, why would they emphasize, have an acronym of war? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've already said you don't fight hate with hate. Mm-hmm. You don't fight darkness with darkness. And so I'm glad that it's different. You know, the bearskin makes a better, more effective point. I hate to admit that. But anyway, that's my two cents worth. And I have no idea whether that's a change or not.
I don't know actually if they've changed that yet. What's fire? That might be the women's studies group. It probably is still war. And that actually happened when I was still the director of the Women's Center. And I cringed when students came and said that's what they wanted to call the group. And I drug my feet for a long time about that. And finally, I thought a couple of different things. At the very same time, a bunch of students wanted to start a queer studies program and have a queer studies office. And I just thought, oh, please, you know, isn't there some less inflammatory way to do this? So actually, I decided to let the students decide, for themselves. It's their student group. But what a compromise that they agreed to is that every time there was that word war, like on the T-shirts or on the posters, they showed the guy standing in front of the tank at Tiananmen Square. That was their logo, maybe still is their logo. So it sort of got the idea across that war happens, and here we are putting our little bodies out there trying to do something to stop it. And that was their mission, and I, you know, about the language, I wholeheartedly agree, but that's what they picked.
I have a question. You have framed your discussion this morning in terms of K-State, but I'm kind of curious about this really disappointing return to forcing students to report rather than receive support. Have you looked at K-State's sister institutions? Are other comparable programs also rolling back time? Is there a nationwide momentum?
You know, I think we started rolling back around the Reagan administration. It's just amazing how short human lives are compared with the changes that need to happen. I don't think I fully realized that when I was 20 or even 30. We have looked everywhere, and in fact, even with the federal changes, there are universities who provide an advocate for women, and we still can here, and I'm sure that people will work to make that happen. The last two or three years, we really tried to let our bosses move the Women's Center back under the Counseling Center, where it is in a lot of places. We actually, it just existed out of there for a long time, and it worked for us, but it's not working anymore. So I think there's a lot of other ways to do it, and stepping back to find some of those places and then reforming a group and coming at it again. We'll be faster this time because there's more people that get it. Okay, meeting time. Thank you all. Thank you, buddy.
Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for your good work. Thanks for all the questions. Now let us stand as you're able and sing One More Step, number 168.
One more step.
take one more step. There is peace for us, and everyone will take one more step. One more word, we'll take one more word, till every word is heard, and everyone, one more word. One more prayer, say one. Let me close with these words from Dorothy Day. People say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pool causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has the right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do. Let's do a good job of it.